This is Microbe Mail, and I'm your host, Vindana Chibabai. This episode closes our brief focus on HIV in the USA and South Africa. We continue our conversation with one of South Africa's top HIV experts, Professor Francois Venter.
So we're going to move now beyond those opportunistic infections and you wanting to initiate this patient on antiretroviral therapy. Are there any additional tests you need to do before initiation? And would that include things like baseline resistance testing?
So I think the only two contraindications to initiation are TD meningitis and cryptomeningitis. Just get that out of your head. So, and that's only, those patients are ill. You know, they really are stuffed and you need to be careful there. And the reason being is they get iris in their brains and their brains swell up and they die. So there are guidelines for deferral. And you must just go and read those and just take care. And those patients really are in the hospital and they sickies and they do badly. So just those patients need some thoughtfulness and some care. And you guys probably who are at the hospitals know this. And there you need to delay the antiretrovirals. For everyone else, the general rule of thumb is get them onto ARVs as quickly as possible. And usually you can start on the same day. The old days when I started training was like, you have to punish them with, you know, sort of counseling for like months and months on end before they be allowed the ARVs. We generally start on the same day, if at all possible, because you can start the counseling at the same time, you know. And so whatever, there are situations where you wouldn't. In ICU, I generally, if the patient's unstable, we wait until you're on top of what's going on in ICU. You don't really want to hoy a whole lot of like new drugs into somebody and get an iris or something if they're unstable. So, you know, in that situation, you admit the patient, get control of them. And if they're in the ICU for months, there you would initiate the ARVs once you've got more of a handle on what's going on. So those kind of situations, you would defer ARVs. But otherwise, get them going. You know, iris is scary when it happens, and I'm sure many of you have had experience of it, but it's handleable. You know, and you just need to deal with it as it comes. There have been not brilliant studies, but there have been studies on iris which generally show that patients who are starting ARVs quickly, they have higher rates of iris, but they live longer, or they're more likely to live. And it makes sense. You know, you kind of get the immune system coming up and, you know, you're going to get more abscesses and things cropping up. Yeah. But the immune system is also going to protect them from all the nasties that come along the way. Right. So I think the rule of thumb is just generally get them onto their therapy as quickly as you can, mm-hmm. safely and responsibly. And, you know, in the age of the current first-line therapy, there's so little to think about other than their renal function. There's, and even that's like almost an afterthought. You know, you generally just need to make sure their social circumstances are such that they're going to be able to tumble into something that's got a fighting chance of them taking the tablet. Mm-hmm. I think, as I said, you know, just make sure they don't have something growing in their brain and they're not in an unstable situation like ICU. Get them onto the therapy as quickly as possible.
Okay. So we're going to start our patient now, but we need to also take care of this patient going forward. So what prophylaxis and routine monitoring are we going to do for a patient with especially with a C4 count of less than 100, for example, you know, to start? When are we going to perform the viral load and when are we going to perform a CD4 count if after we've initiated?
So you did touch on two things I didn't even touch on actually. You know, cotrimoxazole prophylaxis is life-saving and still gets omitted way too often. For anyone with a CD4 count of less than 200, anyone with oral thrush, anyone with a significant opportunistic infection, the guidelines are all there. You know, you can stop it quite soon once their CD4 count goes over 200. But anyone who's super ill should be on cotrimoxazole. It really is remarkable, Muti. And the interesting thing is the poorer somebody is, the worse their social circumstances, the more benefit they get. You know, there's actually been studies demonstrating benefits against malaria in sort of the countries north of us. There's all sorts of benefits, even to the household. So it's not just against BCP, it's against toxo, it's against bacterial pneumonias, against diarrhea. So it's a wonderful, safe medication. There's no reason for them not to be on PCP prophylaxis. The other prophylaxis, which is absolutely life-saving, and I must tell you, I was a skeptic 20 years ago about this, is INH prophylaxis. And there has been study after study on this. Is this, you know, you do your basics to exclude active TB, in which case, obviously, you give them TB therapy. But INH prophylaxis is absolutely life-saving. Our study, the advanced study, we gave, well, this is a study of over 1,000 people. You know, by the end of the study, we had had 7 cases of TB in over 1,000 HIV-positive patients, mainly because we gave them INH, and most of those cases were in the first 6 months, so they probably had TB already. Mm-hmm. So it's astonishing how effective this drug is. You know, in South Africa, these patients are all from Hillbrow. So, you know, this, which is hardly a low TB zone, it's incredible how effective INH prophylaxis is. So if you don't want your patients to come in with TB, give them INH. And if you don't, if you want them protected from the other cohorts, give them cotrimoxazole. So that's the starting point. And you don't need to separate it anymore from starting your ARVs. We used to like sometimes start the one and not the other. And there was a big debate about which one. You can hoy all of them on the same day. It's not a big deal. I mean, obviously counsel your patients and talk about and all the rest, but all those tablets are incredibly well tolerated. We don't fuss anymore about alcoholism and, you know, liver function tests and all the rest of it. Mm. So, Rome, I keep not answering your question, which is which blood test. The basics are you don't need to wait for any blood test to come back. It's nice to have a viral load. It's not absolutely essential. Part of the reason to have a viral load is sometimes to detect that the patient's on, especially in these very ill patients, is was the patient on ARVs when they arrived? Because sometimes they were, and you can get kind of a clue if it's very low. Having a baseline CD4 count is nice because, and actually one of the most useful tests because it does give you an idea of whether to give them cotrimoxazole. And also if they're iris, you know, what their iris with at a CD4 count of 10 is very different from what happens when their CD4 count's 800. So it's really useful to get that CD4 count. I would argue one of the most useful tests before they start ARVs. It's nice to have a liver function test, a full blood count, not essential to start ARVs. So it really depends on where you're working. And the guidelines are quite clear, the state guidelines and the clinician society guidelines as to what you have. The one test that is very useful is a creatinine and the calculated clearance, simply because tenofovir does have an impact on the creatinine clearance. And that is fairly predictable. It's a very, very safe drug. I did my PhD on it. And the reason it does impact on the kidney usually is when there's another thing that's horrible that's going wrong. Either the patient's septic or they're on other nephrotoxic drugs. It seems like then tenofovir can be a real problem. And certainly when I talk to the hospitalists, particularly the nephrologists, those are the patients they see. There'll be a patient who was given an aminoglycoside or who came in with, you know, pneumococcal septicemia or something like that. Those patients often get a bit of a hammering from tenofovir. So, you know, that's when you want a baseline creatinine just to keep an eye on. But in younger patients, they tend to sail through it. You also want to be a little bit careful with patients who have risk factors for underlying renal disease, and that's, you know, type 2 diabetics for any reason. You know, the patients with fairly severe untreated hypertension, that kind of thing, you want to keep an eye on the creatinine at regular intervals. But as I said, tenofovir is actually, in the general scheme of things, a very, very safe drug. The other components, dolutegravir and 3TC, are in general very safe. Dolutegravir does have a drug interaction potential with some of the antiepileptics and with metformin. You just need to keep an eye on that. But generally with epileptics, you just always look at what the drug interactions are that they've got with whatever antiretrovirals they use. You just go to the Liverpool site and you check that out. So CD4 count, yes. Creatinine, yes. Other things are nice to have, including the viral load, and you just need to keep an eye on them as the patient stays on their therapy, and at regular intervals, you just follow that up. So the clinician society and the state guidelines have got tables for monitoring on all these blood tests. You know, obviously, in private, where there's a little bit more permission in terms of the numbers of tests, you might just look at them a little bit more commonly. By and large, it's just really, I think the viral load becomes very important to keep an eye on once the patient is established on therapy, because that's your gold standard for telling whether they're taking their therapy. Right. And, you know, the CD4 count's great for telling you where you are and at the start and where the trouble is coming, particularly in the first 3 or 4 months. After that, the be-all and end-all is the viral load for monitoring. And then it's simple.
Right.
Okay. So I think you answered all my follow-up questions, which is great. Now, I just want to add, I very much agree with the TB prevention is absolutely critical. And we actually have new guidelines on TB infection that were released last year, which are quite revolutionary in terms of the approach, adding a whole bunch of new drugs, as well as really broadly expanding who is eligible for it. So we'll put that in the show notes, because it's a bit there's so many use cases that it's just a bit much to discuss at this stage. But yeah, no, thanks. I think you answered all the monitoring questions.
And thanks, Ron. And I think that people need to understand is that the TB world is moving at a rate of knots after decades of doing absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's so exciting to watch, you know, to see that people are thinking about new ways of dealing with first-line MDR-TB and TB prophylaxis. And again, it's important to keep your eye on the space, but also to understand, you know, that our existing tools are incredibly effective. Mm-hmm. So simple IPT for 6 months works like a bomb. Simplifying that is wonderful, but we must keep using our established tools, because my worry is that very few people actually just get IPT. Mm. You know, finding better and simpler drugs is great, but we must get our clinicians to understand that TB prophylaxis needs to be front and center of their approach to HIV. And sadly, you know, even Bactrim prophylaxis, cotrimoxazole prophylaxis, hasn't enjoyed the attention it's needed, and TB prophylaxis certainly hasn't. But these new approaches hopefully will reinvigorate the field and get people to take it on. It's just been so wonderful that watching South Africans grabbing everything by the scruff of its neck and taking it forward. The whole TB world is, you know, like being electrified by this stuff.
Absolutely. So, Francois, we're going to take this patient who's been on treatment now, and let's assume they've had virological suppression for about 5 years, but the most recent HIV viral load has bumped up and it's kind of sitting at about 2,000 copies per mil, repeated 3 months later, and it's still over 1,000 copies per mil. And we know that this patient is being treated with tenofovir, emtricitabine, and dolutegravir. What should the next steps be in this sort of situation?
So this is very common. And I think the first thing is to understand treatment as a whole has been simplified infinitely. Mm. In fact, I'm practically out of a job because of it. All my life has been focused on drug studies and toxicity of first line and, you know, simplifying things. And for the next probable 4 to 5 years, until the next wave of injectable treatment drugs come along, we probably are going to have tenofovir 3TC or FTC, tenofovir, dolutegravir, so TLD. People, I think it's useful for your treatment community or those of you involved, even peripherally, to understand there's probably not going to be big changes there. There's a possibility of tenofovir dazoproxil fumarate, the one we use at the moment, TDF, being replaced with tenofovir alafenamide. It's more for cost than anything else.
Right.
It's drug company propaganda that it's better for your kidneys. I've just reviewed a paper that came out yesterday, actually, that showed almost no difference when switching from one to the other on your GFR. So just be aware that, you know, it's almost a cosmetic change. But anyway, so it's just nice to know that there's not going to be big changes to first line and second line and third line into the next few years. As I said, prevention is a different story. There's a revolution happening there. So this patient is essentially low-level viremic on an incredibly well-tolerated regimen, and it's going on for a while now. And now this is incredibly common, probably occurs in about 10 to 20% of patients. And until about 4 or 5 months ago, our first go-to would have been non-adherence. And you would have been. And about in September last year in Cape Town, we had the big resistance conference. And we were for the first time seeing dolutegravir resistance on first line. It's a tiny number of cases, but we're seeing it in South Africa. We had cases from Kenya, from Malawi, and from around the world. Isolated cases, but sufficient numbers. You know, and the thing about South Africa is we've got around 5.5-6 million people on treatments, probably 80-90% of them on dolutegravir now, mm-hmm. and the rest on taverns, mainly in the private sector. So it's in Malawi and Kenya, they're all on dolutegravir. So even if we're seeing 10 or 15 cases, in fact, I think in Kenya it was 6 cases, you know, we do need to be conscious that, mm-hmm. you know, when you're treating 6 million people, you are going to start seeing these cases slowly creeping into the system.
Yeah.
Now, you have to juxtapose that with efavirenz resistance, where it was 10% per year. So, you know, in South Africa, we had 500,000 efavirenz resistance cases pretty much at the time we switched across dolutegravir. So it's orders of magnitude greater. Mm-hmm. So it's actually still incredibly rare in South Africa. I think the NHLS people were talking about 15 or 20 cases that I identified. And a lot of those cases actually had been exposed to dolutegravir before. But even so, there are cases starting to creep into the system. Jeremy Nell described a really scary case of somebody developing dolutegravir resistance in only 4 or 5 months, which made us all sit up. And the patient was completely naive. So, you know, when I was very confidently talking about this 7 months ago, I'd say, you know, it took years for people to develop dolutegravir resistance. We don't really need to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But we do now. The problem is that we will cripple the system if we send off genotypes on all these patients with low-level viremia, because still the vast majority of the patients, the one you're describing now, it's an adherence issue.
Mm.
And, yeah, for a clinician, the thing to talk to them about is, like, firstly, don't be judgmental. Like, honestly, I've never finished the malaria course. I've never finished an antibiotic course. I've never finished anything in my life before, you know, like, so before you get on your high horse and start lecturing about adherence, the correct way is to start with empathy and start saying, listen, like, it looks, you know, looking at your viral load, you're not swallowing your tablets every day. You need to, the nice thing about dolutegravir is you actually can get away with far lower levels of adherence than with efavirenz.
Mm-hmm.
But this person's obviously probably taking their tablets 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah.
And you just need to sit down with them and say, listen, is there stuff happening in your life that's really not going right? You know, like, can we put the tablets somewhere where you can see them? Can we structure some sort of adherence intervention? Are you drinking? Is your marriage in trouble? Is there stuff happening in your life that's stressing you? Like, what's going on? Like, is there something that we can talk about? Is there a side effect? You know, even though they're very well tolerated, it's occasionally is the case that this combination can cause trouble. Often ask about sleep, because that is the one thing that dolutegravir can affect occasionally, very occasionally. So just be curious, you know, about their lives and just talk to them and say, listen, you've done so well. It seems a pity to drop the ball at this late stage.
Right.
Also understand that if there is resistance, that you can usually get on top of it. In advance, we had a large number of patients become viremic with this level of viremia. And we got on top of almost every single one of them by simply putting them in and talking to them like this and just saying, listen, you know, things are a little bit out of control. What's going on? And showing them the results, talking to them nicely, and they're all just suppressed again. Mm-hmm. And then the girl back in Cape Town showed this years ago, even with the efavirenz patients, and they've shown it elsewhere. It's just I call it the chat. You know, if you sit there and waggle your finger at them and tell them how bad they are, that's not going to work. But if you try and just, I always say this is the difference between a good healthcare worker and a bad one, or an average one, is work out why they're not swallowing their tablets. And if hand on heart, you've worked and worked and worked at this, and you know, you might have to work towards a genotype to see if they actually do have resistance. Having said that, that even if you get that and it does show resistance, you still have to work out why they're not swallowing their tablets. And then you have to think about giving them a protease inhibitor, which is has serious side effects, is expensive, involves lots of tablets. You know, it's a tough one. Mm. So it's really worth investing in that conversation, and it's a tough one. Like, I don't have easy answers. It's one of those ones where, who's in front of you? Is it a rural woman in, you know, in KwaZulu-Natal who's battling to make ends meet and is, you know, in some sort of gender violence situation? Or is it in some sophisticated lawyer who's doing cocaine in Sandton? Like, it really, like, those are the kind of environments you need to be thinking about. It's like, you know, it's who are you talking to and how, what's the context? And that's how you have to tailor that conversation. And you have to think about where that conversation goes.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thanks.
Yeah, no, it's really important. So just a final question. We assume now we managed to get a resistance test for this patient. And unfortunately, the Stanford printout tells a horror story. We have high-level resistance to integrase inhibitors, protease inhibitors, NRTIs, and NNRTIs. You know, in South Africa, when we reach that situation, do we have options?
So I have not seen somebody die because of resistance in the last 20 years. Firstly, you've got the third line committee still available. It might be altered in the next few months simply because there's so little demand for it. But you've also got, again, you've got incredibly experienced people. In fact, probably more experienced people than anywhere outside of Europe and America locally. So phone a friend, you know, get people involved, get your local virologists and, you know, we've actually got GPs who've got incredible experience now interpreting. Firstly, remember Stanford, and the people who designed Stanford will tell you this to your face, was designed for genotyping for one drug with single dose, single drug resistance. So interpreting the Stanford is always important to remember. It's a guide. It's not a great guide. You know, it was never developed for dual therapy or even for triple therapy or what the stuff we're doing at the moment with a whole range of new drugs. So when it says very resistant, that doesn't mean the drug doesn't work. And in fact, there's a lot of strange stuff that's come out over the last 5 years since the Ernest study. A lot of Nick Payton's work on second line suggests that a lot of these drugs, particularly NRTIs, hold a lot of residual activity. In fact, a lot of activity, even though Stanford says they should have absolutely no activity whatsoever. So this comes into the realm of those terms we use, like crippling the virus. And, you know, these are clinician terms which probably make virologists go pale. But I think it's important to understand is that the Stanford's a guide. It's not, you know, it's not the Holy Grail, and it certainly probably is a very flawed way of interpreting the report. Having said that, what that does say to you is that this patient is into the realm of limited options and should be handled with care and with expertise. So if you are the primary care physician and you've got this person in front of you sitting in the rurals and you're the only person who's looking after them, and this person's not going to be able to get in a minibus to Durban and get looked after, call in the troops, get some help. There's amazing WhatsApp groups to help you here. There are people you should have access to, people who really care about this. You know, I think the infectious diseases community is a really good one and they really want to help. But what you would do in this situation is you would tailor a regimen around that that should be available. In the state sector, we have access to all the drugs actually that you could possibly want. And as I said, we would probably tailor a regimen around a boosted protease inhibitor, darunavir, and add on the drugs based on what you're talking about. It may well actually include dolutegravir simply because it's so powerful, even in the face of resistance. And then add on a combination of NRTIs. We would hum and haw about whether we add etravirine and things like that. And we would construct a regimen for this patient, paying close attention to how good you are as a clinician in terms of dealing with the various social factors and things. And we do this all the time. The third line committee is very thoughtful. They're largely GPs and generalists. And they often have long debates about the social aspects of it. So the short answer is there's plenty of hope. Again, the biggest problem here is getting that person to swallow their tablets. And that for me would be probably what the third line committee would be sitting chatting online about and having this discussion with the clinician concerned. In the private sector, it's sometimes a bit harder to get access to those drugs because of the medical aid politics and bureaucracy. But even there, you know, I think that access is relatively available. And, you know, what you can sometimes do is move that person into, if they're in one of the big cities, into one of the academic clinics and try and see if you can access the drugs through there if the patient's prepared to sit in queues. So the short answer is there's hope and there should be access to the drugs.
Fantastic.
Awesome. So Francois, that was absolutely fantastic. I loved your approach to all of those questions. Just one final question is, do you have any take-home messages for our listeners, just to summarize what we chatted about today?
I think that I think HIV is a very exciting field. I think infectious diseases is an incredibly exciting field. I'd encourage people to be excited about it. I hated immunology as a medical student, and I got very excited about when I did HIV. I think there's lots of micro thinking about treatments at the moment that's probably unnecessary. I think for clinicians, it's much more important to get into your patient's head to try and work out what's happening with their social issues and that now. We've solved treatment for the moment. There are things to be careful about, like I said, kidney function and prophylaxis. I think the hospitalist stuff and the advanced medicine, the advanced patients are a real nightmare and you need expertise there. After that, it really is about being a really good empathic clinician, nurse or doctor or pharmacist to try and get them through the long haul. They need to age well. And then, you know, just a friend of mine put it very well. It's like, respect the struggle. You know, taking tablets every day is hard work. And just understand that, especially in countries complicated as South Africa. I don't know what goes on in people's heads that makes them stop taking tablets. It seems like such a simple thing. I take a tablet every day and the mornings I wake up and I'm like, oh my God, I can't remember if I took it or I didn't. And that's made me have to pause. I just think like people who have pill boxes must be the most, must have the IQ of boiled pumpkin, you know? And now I'm like, oh my God, like maybe I should go and buy one of these things. So I think it's worth reflecting on those things. Right. I think keep an eye on the prep space. But I think the next challenge is you're going to have to get good at treating people getting older with HIV. So that stuff is hard. Like being au fait with these GLP-1s and these anti-obesity medicines and hypertension again. I was having to read the bloody asthma guidelines this weekend just because some of my patients with asthma trying to work out what's going on. And the hypertension guidelines, all that stuff. The sad reality is either stay in infectious diseases and stay in your lane or stay away from HIV or otherwise understand you have to become a bloody generalist again because those patients, the initiation of antiretrovirals, once they're out of the hospital and they're getting better, is actually really simple. And it's a testament to the HIV world, but absolutely, it's created a whole new scary new world for the rest of us.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely incredible the work that's been done and how far we've gotten with HIV. And as you said throughout the episode, the people in South Africa, millions of or hundreds of experts that have come together and gotten the country to as far as we have. We are so grateful that you joined us today, Francois. I know we struggled to pin you down and get you here talking, but I'm so glad we finally got it right. It has been absolutely incredible. We really, really appreciate it. It's been so insightful. And I'm very sure we're going to get excellent feedback from our listeners as well. Rowan, anything from you?
No, I think we covered everything that's important about HIV in South Africa. It's really, really great. Thanks a lot.
Absolute pleasure. Take care, you guys. Lovely to talk to you.
Great.
Thank you.
Listeners, remember to give us your feedback by email or on social media. And also don't forget to add that 5-star rating if you haven't yet. So that's it from us, your micro messengers. That's Vin, Ruan, Vinitha, Nonx, Esther, and Fatima. We'll see you again soon with more Contagious Meds.